Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Lob podcast with These Football Times. I'm Aidan Williams and we're into the centre circle again with another fabulous book to discuss with another great author too on a World Cup theme, which is perfect for where we are right now. Before we get onto that though, I've got Dave Bowler with me tonight to help me chat through it all with this author. So how are you doing there, Dave?
All right, thanks. A full day of World Cup activity to enjoy.
Days don't come much better than that. Full days of World Cup activity. And now we get to chat more World Cup after all the action's ended. Perfect. Spoiler alert, yes. So we're only day one of the World Cup. Day two, I suppose. We've just seen Wales and their draw. So, you know, anything we discuss that's happened after that, it's not our fault. We haven't seen it yet. With us tonight, though, is the author of the excellent book, How to Win the World Cup, Secrets and Insights from International Football's Top Managers. It's Chris Evans, who's a freelance football writer, worked with 442, Guardian, various other places. Set Pieces as well, I think, is your primary one now. How you doing there, Chris?
Yeah, not too bad. How are you doing?
All very good. Very much looking forward to getting into this topic because, well, it's a fascinating subject and it's, I guess, a slightly different perspective on talking about World Cups and how to achieve them, all the great things. We usually focus more specifically on the field, don't we? Whereas here, you're looking at a lot of aspects that come into thinking and come into play off the field in terms of how to actually set things up and how to work through. So initially, why did you pick this topic, Chris? What was it that appealed about this to you?
I mean, I guess there's two sides to it. So I've always been fascinated by managers. I don't know if that's just kind of an obsession with Championship Manager and Football Manager, but I think there's always something that's quite interesting about them. And actually, interviewing managers normally it's more insightful than perhaps the players when they're still playing, because you're kind of you're finding out the hows and whys almost with the manager. In a manager press conference, you normally do get some juicier bits than perhaps getting a player as soon as they come off the pitch. So that kind of is where that started. But also, I guess with the World Cup, like you say, we do a lot of focusing on the players, the stars. We remember those moments that they create. But the managers are almost what has created that environment for them to achieve that. And actually, the managers can either be allow them to go and create and do something brilliant, or they can actually stifle them. So going and doing that and a different twist on the World Cup was something that I was quite keen to do.
Yeah, it's great. Dave, obviously what Chris is saying there, it's really quite interesting because some of the times, especially when it comes to a tournament, I think people overlook the manager's influence a lot and just think, well, it's, you know, it's the good players and they don't need the manager. How much are they actually doing? Lots of people kind of think that kind of thing about some of the great teams, let alone some at the other level who probably need more assistance.
It's interesting. I mean, somebody at the end of the day has to be responsible for the whole picture, don't they? You know, I mean, in club football, we always put the onus on the manager. You know, it's the great Alex Ferguson, the great Brian Clough, or Bill Shankly, or whoever it is. I think we see international football more through the spectrum of the great player, the Cruyff, the Pele, the Maradona. But you know, going through the book, and one of the interesting things about the book was it wasn't just about winning the World Cup. It was about you win the World Cup just by getting there for some countries. You know, that's their equivalent of it, and it's all down to somebody taking the responsibility for it, choosing the team, picking the players, the training methods, and all of that. And it's such a different thing to what we are used to with club management all the time. And I thought it was a really, really good perspective on that.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think, you know, if I think back to incidents like Euro 2016 when Portugal got to the final and you see on the sidelines Ronaldo directing operations and you kind of think, well, is he trumping the manager or is he really kind of on par with the manager, or in tune with the manager, sorry, and saying the same things and passing on the messages as it should be. Or you think of teams with other greats in like Messi and so on, and think, well, how much influence does the manager have when there's this strong character who's possibly overplaying things? But, you know, we'll get into some of what the managers actually have influence and the other areas. But Chris, like your writing process for this, you've already mentioned the interviews and how interesting they were, but there's a lot of interviews with a lot of very high-powered, high-profile international managers in this book, which is, you know, obviously that adds huge heft and huge insight into what you're doing here. In terms of your writing process, I guess, before we get into the actual topics, how did you go about that? I mean, there's some people here where I wouldn't know how to start trying to contact, and yet here they are talking to you about their innermost insights from World Cup campaigns. It's quite incredible.
I mean, to be honest, I think I remember this had been going on for quite a while, that I'd been pitching it and working on the idea with Bloomsbury and the commissioning editor there. And then finally, when the contract got over the line, I think I completely just crapped myself, to be honest. So I suddenly thought, I've committed to this. How am I going to do it? And I think that it's a strange thing, really, because it became this sort of like fear of failure almost, that I thought I was going to, you know, fail. And any while I got like a very modest advance, I thought I'd end up having to pay the advance back, because they'd be like, who was this chancer who blagged his way in? So I think it was just a case of just finding new ways. And actually, I found, you know, I'd done quite a few different interviews. I'd regularly, you know, work with 442, and sometimes they'll give you interviews, but other times, you know, I've got to find them myself. So I'd got a little bit of, you know, that knowledge behind it, but actually not a case of going after people who were retired, who were in different parts of the world. That was a challenge. It's weird though, because you'd say for all of the people that are in there, and it's brilliant actually, and everyone, whoever's kind of picked up the book, has kind of said about that. But I always look at it at the ones who got away almost. And I looked at the people who I thought I could get, who I was very close to getting over the line, like Gus Hiddink and Louis van Gaal. And I kind of like, oh, I'd have loved to have got them in. And then it's quite strange because, I guess you only see it from your perspective. And I did kind of over 70 interviews. And I think I was fortunate in a very sort of weird way of saying it, that I was doing this at the end of 2020 and the start of 2021, the interviews at least. So I think a lot of people were at home and they were perhaps more willing to chat than they perhaps would be in a normal time. But yeah, I think it just kind of gained momentum, and I think I just probably became a bit of an obsession for several months. The first few months was getting the interviews, and then it was kind of actually delivering the words to the deadline that I'd got. And I think yeah, I probably wasn't the best person to live with, because it was probably the only thing I was really thinking about at that time. So, but, you know, I guess it's just the way that it is. You've written a book, so you kind of know what it's like, I guess.
Oh, I can certainly relate to that. The feeling at the start of the process is like, oh God, what have I done? And where do I go from here? And you're right. You map it out and you think, oh my God, that's a lot to cover. How am I going to go about this? You said there like 70 odd interviews. So was there anyone who didn't make the cut into the final book?
There were a few, actually. There were a few. And some people who gave really good interviews. But the problem was that, because the way that the book had to go and the way I was briefed into doing it, it had to kind of go in a flow. So there were some people that I kind of had on multiple lists for chapters where I go, and they just didn't appear. So one of the guys, Dan Eggen, who played for Norway, and obviously Egil Olsen's quite an interesting manager, but it never quite fit within that sort of realm. And actually, one of the things I've done the second half of this year during kind of like promoting the book has been actually putting together pieces based on some of the quotes that didn't actually make it into the book as well. So you kind of do fuller pieces from those managers. So for example, I did something with like Zlatko Dalic, who's like Croatia manager, and there were some really good bits that came out, but actually there was a really nice flowing, you know, I did 2000 word feature on that. And I think it's quite interesting really, because it's kind of got this depth of information that a lot of this stuff is probably just going to sit on my laptop and never be seen almost. And that's, you know, that is quite interesting. You could have doubled the length of the book, to be honest. You know, there was so much out there.
Well, let's get into some of the themes then. Obviously, a key one in all of this is how different international management is from club management, to the extent, you know, you could essentially call it an entirely different job, even though many people don't think that, you know, you still hear people complain that the international manager hasn't achieved anything at club level and all that kind of thing. And yet it's such a different skill set, isn't it? You know, the amount of time, the time is the key thing in two respects. One, amount of time you get with the players, which is so limited. Then conversely, the huge amount of time you get to sort of mull over each result without being able to do anything about it. Whereas the club game, you can focus on those issues and try and put it right within a few days or the next week. It's such a contrast. Now, what was really fascinating was Roberto Martinez, the Belgium manager, obviously very familiar in this country. And you interviewed him and he talks about having to change his mindset entirely. Obviously, he's someone who did have several years as a club manager, but he was surprised by the difference. Now, that's bizarre because, I don't know, it seems quite obvious that it's so different. I mean, did that take you back as well? Take you aback a little bit? Because it just seems an odd thing.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of people have picked up on that and kind of saying it and saying, well, it does seem like quite an obvious thing. But then I guess, you know, you do look at another example in the book, although I didn't speak to him, Antonio Conte took over Italy. It was kind of like the dream job. And he was about the same sort of, you know, age and perhaps stage. Maybe he was a little bit further ahead of Martinez because he'd managed Juventus. But Conte kind of saw this role as being something for him, but very quickly realised that he didn't, you know, his temperament was he wanted to be in it. He wanted the cut and thrust. And I think that's, again, it seems surprising that it'd be quite a few people that are finding that. But then I think maybe it's just they don't consider it. And I think actually there's a lot of fans and actually see the reaction. Gareth Southgate's a great example of that, that people don't appreciate the work that he does and actually what counts as success in the international game rather than the club game. And I think when everyone talks about Southgate being negative and too conservative, actually the point is that a lot of winners, past winners, the managers have been unpopular because they have been too pragmatic or negative. So there's just a whole different way of working. And I know that Jose Mourinho and Pep Guardiola have kind of said they'd like to give it a go as an international manager when they retire from the club game. But I'm not so sure that either of those would work because that level of control that they want. And I think that's a big thing for managers. And I think this is why, you know, you see the likes of Capello come in and it didn't really work for them. But you're seeing more recently this kind of growth of the specialist international manager, the one who's kind of worked up through the ranks and is that sort of company guy, like Jurgen Löw and Gareth Southgate. And I think that's something that you're going to see more and more of in the future.
What do you think on that, Dave? Like, totally different job. The requirements to become successful are completely different. I guess not completely, but, you know, you get what I mean.
I think it's changed a lot over the, I don't know, probably the last 20, 30 years. I mean, I think if you look back to the 60s and 70s, the international manager was always the wise old owl who'd, you know, done his trade for 20 years in the league. You know, you think of Alf Ramsey, although he wasn't actually that old. He just looked like he was that old. But, you know, Helmut Schön, people like that, you know, they'd been around a bit. And now, you know, I think you're right about people like Mourinho and Guardiola. When they get to that point at which they've had enough time with club football, I'm not sure that international footballers will look at a guy who's 60, 65, and want anything to do with him anymore. And I think that was perhaps one of the problems with Capello. And I was interested in a lot of the stuff that you were talking about Jürgen Klinsmann around the German World Cup and staying in the hotels in the city and being a part of the whole process of the World Cup and belonging to the country and all that kind of thing. And I think, you know, obviously footballers have changed over the last 30, 40, 50 years. And I think the way you have to manage them has changed as well. And I think Klinsmann in particular started that kind of trend, which was very interesting. But the stuff about the federation, the institutional coaches, as Southgate's become, I think as well that has become something that's more and more necessary now because it is a different game. But also, you know, Southgate, perhaps not this group that he's got now, but he will have managed a lot of England players when he was the 21s coach, brought them through. Then he, when he first took over as England boss, he got an insight into them. They already had respect for him. And he wasn't being imposed on them just because he'd won the league with Liverpool or whoever it was. So I think that side of the book was really interesting. And the Southgate thing about going and talking to Welsh and Scots internationals as to why it was that they loved going and playing for the country. And then he said, well, we used to dread it going and playing for England. I mean, that was a really powerful thing. And you don't get the impression that those guys who played for England today, whether they're going to do well, do badly, or whatever, they look like they're enjoying it. And that is a big change, I think.
I guess part of that is Southgate on that theme. He's remained loyal to a core group of players, irrespective in some cases of their club form. And I guess that's sort of part of, you talk about institution and the whole sort of atmosphere around going on international duty. I guess that helps feed that if you know you've got that backing, even if you're in a slump with your club. Look at Harry Maguire, obviously coming into the World Cup, and he's had a good game today until he had to go off. It must make a difference. I mean, do you think, Chris, is that hugely important? And we talked there also about the camps in the World Cup, and obviously having that core probably helps that. I mean, this is the other extreme of international football, isn't it? You go from having a few days here and there to suddenly you have 6 weeks together, and it's such a contrast. And I guess that core possibly helps.
Well, there's two sides to it. I mean, first of all, I would say that the soft skills as an international manager is perhaps even more important than in the club game, because you have got this idea that you need to create a camp where you're living on top of each other. And this is perhaps why you do find there are more big incidents and, you know, things explode during a World Cup and the controversies, because these people and characters, as people, are living with each other, and people, they do it. And actually, you put people into this high pressure, you know, fishbowl of the World Cup, and these things explode. So as a manager, you're kind of the puppet master for that. You need to make sure you've got the right people together. You need to make sure that you're treating, I guess, there's this sort of holistic thing. And I think that, you know, you do see that with Southgate, and he did the sort of psychometric tests and working out what kind of characters they were and how his players learned and all things like that. And I think that's really, really key, that he knows who works best. And I think that that's, you know, it's a dry side of it, but actually that's probably a lot of where he's filling his time. Whereas as a club manager, you perhaps move those players on if they don't fit in, and you don't really have that luxury of the transfer market. So say those soft skills are important. But I think the next side of it is continuity. Continuity is very important in the international game, because if you keep on chopping and changing, you're never going to, you know, you're not going to find something that feels familiar. Ottmar Hitzfeld spoke about that for when he was with Switzerland, that he would have a core of 14, 15, 16 players that would always be in every squad if they were fit and available. And that said, he said that was regardless of club form too. So you kind of see Southgate doing that with the likes of Harry Maguire. And I know people have questioned, say, like Jordan Pickford before. But if they haven't let you down in that environment with those leaders and that dynamic, then that really does count for something. So you look around, and especially this year where there was no preparation at all, there's a key reason why I expected John Stones and Harry Maguire to play alongside each other, admittedly in a three, I thought, you know, in a back three rather than a two in the centre of defence today. But you kind of think they need that because they're familiar, and you can't just chuck in two new names and hope that they play with each other, because you'd get found out. And actually kind of going in, it's got to fit and feel right for those players. And a manager has to recognise that.
It's interesting on the theme. It makes you wonder, because obviously we're talking there, England, a country that's got a fair number of players to pick from, and other big nations similar, of whether a slightly smaller country has, I wouldn't say an advantage, because, you know, less to pick from isn't necessarily an advantage, but in terms of group harmony and core squad, it's almost forced on you to some extent for certain players. You know, it's a lack of options means that often it's going to be the core group regardless. And perhaps that helps them build that spirit. And you look at Wales and the spirit in their camp, and how everyone seems to, well, many of them seem to prefer playing for Wales than for their clubs to some extent. You wonder how the smaller pool of players to pick from feeds into that. Interesting one to think on. One other thing I noticed on reading this, which was quite interesting, the interview you did with Jamie Carragher, I thought was really quite interesting, because I was actually surprised that he was really looking forward to the 2010 World Cup, because I honestly thought after the way his 2006 tournament had ended with a penalty miss, obviously in the shootout, and then he stopped playing for England, I thought, well, you know, he had to be dragged kicking and screaming back into the camp. So it was quite interesting to see that that wasn't the case. And of course, it was Fabio Capello, as he says in your interview, was the main driver behind, well, it piqued his interest, I guess, more. World Cup is obviously a big pull factor as well. But, you know, Fabio Capello and the chance to work with him was a huge part of that. But Capello, I guess we're talking there of people whose approach adjusts to the international game, seemed to me like someone who didn't. At least that's the way it came across from Carragher. Is that what you think, and possibly what went wrong for England in that time?
Yeah, I mean, Carragher kind of said that he had all these expectations of what it was going to be like working with Capello, and he just didn't deliver. And I mean, I guess that's the question, perhaps, that was it that Capello worked with that Milan backline every single day, every week of every month, and that's how he drilled them to be what they were. And that's what Carragher liked the idea of doing, and perhaps you could never really translate that into kind of a few weeks on the training ground. But there might be a number of things here, and actually to Dave's point about kind of like an older manager, perhaps they don't have that drive that they did earlier on in their career. I don't know, but there's certainly the impression that Carragher gave off. I mean, I think you look at the character that he is now, I think he talks to a lot of people and does podcasts and does interviews because he loves football, and he's always talking about watching games and finding something in any sort of obscure game that he watches. And I think he, just the way he is, I think it's somebody else might have had a different experience of Capello and looked at it in a different way. But I think Jamie Carragher, being the character he is, I think he would have seen it as a brilliant football experience. And I think that's just who he is. So I think there is, you know, it's really good insight from him. But I think perhaps, it would be a little bit different if you spoke to somebody else who'd been in a similar sort of situation. But yeah, it was fascinating. And I think I quite like the little anecdote that he had that of a lot of the players didn't sit and watch the other games, but it was normally him, Capello, Steven Gerrard, and Baldini that were sat in there watching the games. And I quite like that idea that you kind of got the Scouse crew on one side and the two Italians, and they couldn't really speak the same language. And it always kind of fascinates me. And I can just imagine what it must have been like in there. And, you know, Carragher said that Al Capello would just occasionally shout in Italian at the screen. And I just think it's a really nice sort of a nice little image that you've kind of got in your mind. I think it, for me, it sits there with this whole idea of Sven playing the piano for everyone in Baden-Baden. I just quite like those kind of lifting the lid on what it's really like to be in a World Cup camp.
How would you organise a World Cup camp, Dave?
Good God, we don't want to go into that. I did think that the Carragher interview was dotted throughout the book. I thought that was really, really fascinating because he's kind of an old school character in a lot of ways. He's not of necessarily that golden generation. I mean, he was, you know, talking about England players complaining about they couldn't have ketchup with their evening meal, and you know, it seemed that Carragher was impatient with anybody who didn't think this is a World Cup. We'll do whatever we need to do to win it. And I mean, you know, I wrote a book about Alf Ramsey many years ago, and it seems to me that that's a key change in the personality of the footballers. I mean, that 66 team that won the World Cup, they got plenty of powerful personalities in it. I mean, they weren't, you know, shrinking violets, but they were a generation that was willing to take instruction. And if Alf Ramsey said, this is what we do and this is how we're going to win the World Cup, and said, right, okay, that's what we're going to do. I mean, even Jack Charlton, who occasionally went over the wall at Lillehammer, but yeah, that's another story. But I mean, by and large, they did what Alf told them to do. I don't get the impression that the golden generation were taking a lot of instruction from anybody, and that was certainly something that came through in the book. And again, coming back to Southgate, I think that's been his greatest strength. You know, he's had what, this is his third tournament. He's done amazingly well in two tournaments. Whatever you think of his style of football and whatever, you know, England have done better in these last two tournaments than they've done in generation. And he's found that way to tap into what the modern player is and what the modern player wants, and yet still get them to behave at that level that you need in international football. And I think that's a really fascinating element to it.
Well, let's hope by the time this comes out, he hasn't had a catastrophe in the last few group games. And this won't have aged well. Okay, Chris, you've obviously, I would say, talked to a load of managers, but they were from various different areas of the world. And I think this is kind of an interesting theme to it all as well, that, you know, different different locations, different cultures, people will think differently about how to do things and how to approach, well, not just football in general, but in this case, how to manage and how to organise. So from all this research, did you find much differences or great differences in how winning coaches worked in different parts of the world? Did culture feed into it? Did having, I know some countries have lots of home-based players like England do, and some have none, like a South American country probably does, or an African country nowadays. Does that completely change the job and the approach they have to take?
I mean, there are challenges for everyone, and I think it's, you know, each of the stories is quite different, and I think it's not so much, I would say, national wise that kind of steps them out, and even eras. I would say, you know, like for example, Brazil in 94, they hadn't won the World Cup in 20 odd years, and Carlos Alberto Pereira had this way of changing that, and he got a psychologist in to deal with that. You then have Roberto Martinez, who is talking about, you know, actually, until your nation has won a World Cup, even if you don't know the players, it kind of gives you that affirmation that you can achieve it. And it's harder to win it for the first time than it is for the nation's second tournament. So I think there are different ways all the way through. I think big countries and small countries is probably the biggest change. Actually, something you mentioned earlier about actually if you've got a tight-knit group. And Romania in 1994, for example, like they had a lot of players who'd played at the same club as well. They'd got Angel Iordanescu, who came in and was manager, and he knew those players. And actually, you know, speaking to Ilie Dumitrescu, he said that knowledge helped against Argentina when Romania beat them, because he put Dumitrescu up front in a false nine position, and he hadn't played there for years, but Iordanescu knew that he could because he'd done it previously as a youth at Steaua Bucharest. So, you know, there are some interesting things like that. And I think there's not one kind of silver bullet of how to go about winning it. And I think it's understanding where your nation is and where your players are. I think in terms of people being locally based, you know, if everyone's in England, that helps an England manager, although I'm not sure how much communication there is. I mean, Otmar Hitzfeld spoke about that as well, and actually how he left players alone when they were with their club sides because there was so much noise otherwise. But there are others who kind of travel around and meet their players. The manager of the African sides tend to travel around and have little meetings and go and watch their players play. So I think it's just understanding the challenge and understanding the characters almost and trying to get that right. And I think this is why you could see managers go in, you know, the journeyman managers who perhaps go in and do a good job at one or two countries and not in others, because I guess they can't go and do exactly the same thing again there. And I know that, you know, club managers say that all the time, but I think it's more obvious the differences at international level than at club level, I would say.
There's quite a lot of expat managers around the world, aren't there? You know, as you said there, Chris, some tour the world going from country to country with the difficulties that must pose. But like, firstly, what do you think, Dave, about a foreign manager? Obviously, England's had a couple over the years. Is it harder to come in as an outsider sometimes? Maybe for a big nation, it's different than it is to go as a foreign manager to a small nation that's never come remotely close to qualifying. Perhaps it's an entirely different ballgame there. Do you think, is it much harder for a foreign manager to succeed? No foreign manager has ever won the World Cup to date. A couple have got close, but none have actually won it.
I think it's probably easier when you are one of the smaller nations. If you come in, if it's a country that's happy just to qualify for the World Cup, I think it's probably easier for a foreign manager to come into there, because they will come in with a certain level of respect because they've managed in the Bundesliga, or they've managed in Serie A, or they've managed in the Premier League. And, you know, the smaller country will be, you know, impressed by that. I think for one of the major nations, it's a little bit more difficult, perhaps. But I do think it's to do with that age and with that respect that you get as a player. Because, I mean, footballers have always been, show us your medals. That's always a thing in a dressing room. It's remains now. You know, what did you win? What have you done? What, you know, why are you telling me these things? But I mean, one of the most fascinating areas of the book for me was things like Stephen Constantine in Sudan and Peter Butler with Botswana. I mean, they're books on their own. Never mind chapters. They were. I mean, I don't know, Chris, if you want to tell some of those stories, because they were, I don't know why on earth you would want to do the job that they've done in those places, given what's happened to them.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's quite interesting, because I think these guys, they're really doing it for the love of the game. And actually, I think you compare those guys who perhaps travel the world and achieve things in comparison to, I mean, can we keep using Capello as the example, but, you know, Sven as well, who kind of managed multiple national sides and had limited success. There's probably different motivations for them there. And I know Peter Butler, while initially he went out there because he wanted to be a football manager in his own right, and he perhaps thought he wasn't going to do it over in England, so he kind of went abroad to go and find those opportunities himself. He now kind of sees himself as almost like a humanitarian manager, and I think there's quite a few of them like that. And I guess Stephen Constantine's the same, because he's gone and done brilliant work as part of the development for a number of countries, you know, India, Nepal, you know, real sort of grassroots. And the impact they're having and have had is a lot greater, because they've kind of set the tone and they've done that. And, you know, you look at the basis that they've got, and they're never going to go and win a World Cup. You'll get some that go and qualify for a World Cup. So René Simões, I'm probably butchering the pronunciation of his name, who took Jamaica to the 98 World Cup. He was somebody who kind of got invited to take the job. He took it for 3 months, and then he was there for like 4 years. And he did a lot about changing the whole infrastructure and the way that national body was run, as well as the club. And I think there's a lot of, as well as the team, sorry. And I think there's a lot of that goes on at a lower level. That actually it is the manager is not just looking after a squad of players and getting them out on a Saturday or Tuesday whenever they're playing. They're also kind of putting everything in place, and some of them are even funding it themselves. And, you know, it is fascinating seeing how these guys go about doing the job, and it's a different world for them. Some of them that aren't earning a lot of money, but yeah, and I think they get used to it. And I think this is why you see the same guys kind of going and getting jobs all around the place, because they are used to it and they know those challenges and what you've got to deal with. And actually you kind of get these guys all the way up. You know, Bora Milutinovic is a star. You know, everyone loves Bora. He's had like been in the World Cup 5 times of 5 different nations, but he's managed many more nations than that. He's managed Iraq. Never knew we were going to take them to the World Cup. Obviously, he didn't, but he kind of went in there to do his thing there as well. And I think these guys just do it for the love of the game. And I think sometimes that changes a little bit higher up, you know, and people will always point the money for it, but I don't think it's, I think it's just a different way of looking at it. And I don't think it is financial gain necessarily that motivates all these managers. You know, Capello probably thought he could go and be successful with England, but he's just coming from it in a completely different place than some of these other guys.
I think it's an absolutely fascinating subject. I mean, you know, people who travel the world, essentially taking their skills wherever it leads, you know, coaching, developing, leading various different national teams into different levels of competition, different regional tournaments, and then World Cup qualifiers as well. You get to be part of the bigger picture, but in a wholly different level, a wholly different aspect to it. I think it's absolutely fascinating. It sounds like a magical existence to me. It really does.
There's a picture for Steve Bruce there.
Well, he did similar, just going around England. You know, I'd rather have slightly wider ambitions than that, I think.
I mean, based on both of your accents, I assume you've probably had Steve Bruce experiences, haven't you?
We both have experience of Steve Bruce, but really, Chris, you could pick most accents in the country. You've had some experience of him at this rate. But the likes of the people you talked about there who go and coach off in these far-flung destinations, I think it's absolutely, it can't be idyllic. You know, I'm thinking of it from a romantic perspective. It's not. It's going to some strange places, and as you say, not getting paid much, probably not getting the kind of conditions we think of international football having, but it must be so rewarding in so many ways. You can just imagine. I mean, look at things like it was on Sky documentaries not so long ago, the Next Goal Wins documentary about American Samoa, who had the Dutch coach from US soccer who came over. I know that was a short-term thing and slightly different scale, but you know, the way it can, I don't know, just reward you as a coach, just going to these places and giving expertise that presumably these countries don't have to quite that same level themselves. I think it's absolutely fascinating, a fascinating aspect to it all. But it's worlds away from the top level.
Again, though, right? So it's, and this is where, you know, international level, international football, for all of the non-purity of this World Cup at the moment, there is a purity to the actual sport of it. And I think we've spoken about that from a kind of a playing side, and it's perhaps simpler because there's not as much time for tactical approaches and you know, choreographing things in the same way that like Pep or Klopp do. But international level, there is that purity. And I guess that's where the joy of it comes from to go and do it. And I think that's capturing the essence of what the international game's about. And I think as the club game, you know, goes further and further away from its kind of initial roots, and becomes more, you know, where we'll eventually get to with a Super League by some way or another, it will happen, won't it, in the next decade probably. But international football will kind of be that bastion of purity. And I think that's why it hurts so much about what's kind of going on with Qatar now. And I think this is why there's such a reaction, and some people have kind of reacted with almost apathy to it, because it's spoiling what is, in that month every 4 years, something that's kind of sacred, and it's kind of been infringed. I mean, it's not the only World Cup that's ever had this around it, and you know, there's quite a few of them right back from the very first World Cup that was hosted in Europe with in 1934, because obviously Mussolini funded all of that. So you know, the World Cup has been linked to this, you know, since its inception. But even so, I think it just feels, I guess it's something we should protect at all costs, I would suggest.
Totally agree. Now, you mentioned a little earlier, well, both of you have, I think, about the respect from players to manager. Now, when we're talking there about these more journeyman managers, I guess some of it, as you hinted, comes a little automatically because of where you've come from and the association with that country. But at the highest level, as Dave said, it's about the medals and show me what you've done. Now, your book mentions this around Franz Beckenbauer. Now, obviously, he came with a certain level of aura and achievement naturally, and it worked for him. I guess another example where it didn't, though, in international management would be Maradona, perhaps. You know, you can't come with a bigger aura and achievement than him, but that didn't make him a good coach, and his team were tactically all over the place. But how important is that at the top level, though, to actually, you know, there are some cases where you automatically have that respect, and there's others where it's kind of earned, but maybe that's harder. But is it actually important in the modern day and age at this level for that respect to be there from the off?
I mean, with Beckenbauer and actually with Maradona, like their reaction of going in there was really positive. And I think Beckenbauer was of a time with Germany. And I think even kind of going into 2002, Christian Ziege talks about Rudi Völler. Actually, you go even further to 2006 that Jürgen Klinsmann, while he did a lot of good stuff, and again, I'll, you know, talk about the soft skills and what he achieved there, he wasn't a tactician, and there was criticism. Philipp Lahm criticised Klinsmann about he didn't do anything on the training pitch. You know, Ziege talks about how the players would decide the tactics, and Völler would almost pick the 11 that would go out in 2002. And Beckenbauer was the same almost. Like Pierre Lubarski talks about it, that actually Beckenbauer stuck the names on the wall. That's your 11. Go out and do it. And that was it. So I think this is where it has changed. I think back in the, you know, Beckenbauer won it in 1990. And I think that the world has changed. I think Germany actually is one of the big things they found, that why they got behind everyone else, that no one else was approaching things in that time. And I think almost Beckenbauer, he had a talented group of players, but that respect almost was what won him that World Cup and was what got him there, because people wanted to play for him. And it was that mindset of that generation, I think. I don't think it's quite as effective now, but Jogi Löw was a great example, though, that he was Klinsmann's assistant and he realised that they had to change. But respect was actually one of the big questions around Löw. Was he ever going to be good enough to deliver that World Cup or that major tournament? And they'd lost two semi-finals, they'd lost a final. Was he the man to do it? And perhaps, you know, quite a lot of this is similar to the questions that are being asked of Gareth Southgate at the moment. And, you look at it and actually respect was, is this guy good enough? Does he have the medals? He's never proved it, but he did in the end. And I think there's going to be a lot more of that. And actually look at some of these countries that go and win now, and they've got those trajectories. And I think that's more important than the character now. Didier Deschamps spoke about that himself. And, you know, the French players must have so much respect for him, but it worked for him. But it didn't work for Laurent Blanc before that. And he would have the same respect because he'd achieved so much in the same era. And, you know, arguably, you know, some of the things that that Blanc had done at the club level perhaps was even greater than Deschamps, but it didn't work for him. So I think it almost comes down to the personality now. And I don't think you can just name somebody into a place and make it work. I mean, there is a short-term hit and there is a benefit to that. And, you know, Maradona achieved that when he went in and, you know, sorted them out when, you know, Argentina looked like they might not qualify. And it was that sort of initial euphoria of working with Maradona. And, you know, Jonas Gutierrez tells me in the book how he kind of almost like was so in awe of Maradona that he couldn't even speak to him and he was just sweating and he was just, you know, he couldn't deal with it. And, you know, that was great for a while, but then he was kind of found out at a World Cup that he didn't really have that acumen, although he had brought Carlos Bilardo in as general manager to try and help him, but it didn't quite click again. And I think this is kind of what we spoke about earlier, that I think things have changed and it is now more like you need your FA man to be doing it rather than just picking, you know, the biggest name, the former captain and plopping him in charge. I just don't think that's something that works in the modern game now.
Yeah, I guess this harks back to what you said earlier, Dave, about the old wise owls. You know, things have moved on from that, haven't they?
I think so. I think particularly in the, for want of a better word, the major countries, the countries that are going to tournaments expecting to reach the latter stages and ultimately win the big prizes. I think it needs to be coaches and managers that are in tune with the players, perhaps a little bit closer to their age groups. I think one of the interesting things is you don't get the big tactical revolutions at World Cups that perhaps you're used to in the, you know, in the 50s and the 60s and into the 70s. You know, you and 4-2-4 for Brazil in 58 and the wingless wonders and then total football, although obviously Ajax have been playing something along those lines before. You don't really get those big shifts now, do you? So it's interesting what it is that those managers do to find the edge that makes the difference between, because obviously with television, we know, you know, everybody sees every game that's ever played, and you know, down to park pitches on a Sunday morning, you know, everything's filmed, everything's recorded. So there's no secrets there. But, you know, there's a chapter in the book about finding the edge. What did you find from that, Chris, that particularly made those teams actually get the prize in the end?
I think some of it, I mean, this is where it comes down to the manager. It's what they do to make that edge. And I think sometimes it is about, you know, whether it's that enjoyment factor and it just feels like a nicer environment to be in and you want to be there. And that's the big change that's happened with England or whether it's, you know, Carlos Bilardo, the way that Argentina manages to sustain that time. I mean, he was so crucial in that story. 86, everyone talks about Maradona, but it was Bilardo recognising Maradona. Maradona wasn't in favour. The Argentinians didn't want him to be picked. They definitely didn't want him to be captain. And actually, it was those decisions that Bilardo made that lay all the groundwork for Maradona to go and do it. He couldn't have done it without the freedom that Bilardo allowed him. He perhaps wouldn't have done it if Daniel Passarella had still been like the captain and Maradona had just been in the side. And it's kind of all these key decisions that come together and they dovetail. You know, there are other things as well. You know, Vicente del Bosque did it with Spain in 2010, where he trusted his players and that trust showed them all the way through that they then repaid him. And actually they went out for a night out during the knockouts and they went out and they got absolutely bladdered. And you kind of think, why, you know, you're doing, that's a massive risk. But Del Bosque knew that the people that he'd got, he needed to just ease the tension a little bit and let these guys go out there and show that he trusted them. And I think that sort of bond that that creates. It's just, you know, knockout games, it can be the smallest little thing, and it can be a player taking a risk to play a ball through, or, you know, making a challenge, or, you know, whatever it is, taking a penalty in a shootout. And it's these little things, whether it's a psychological thing, whether it's these little tactical bits that someone's picked up on, it's all of those things kind of coming together. And I think that's the beauty of it. And, you know, to go back to the Bilardo point, that after they won in 86, he's been the closest anyone has come for decades to actually retaining, as a manager, retaining the World Cup. And that was because after that game, he was really unhappy. He was really unhappy at the final in 86 because West Germany had scored twice from corners. And he was more upset about that than he was happy about actually having won the World Cup. It shows you the standards he set and how they managed to get to that final again in 1990. And I think that's quite key. And again, it all comes down to environment. And, you know, ultimately, players couldn't have gone again with Bilardo. But it's just the nature of what it was. And it's his environment. It was his time. But then it wouldn't have worked again if he'd, you know, clearly when he went in with Maradona, his approaches then didn't work. So it's of its time almost. And again, like I said before, there's not a silver bullet.
It's interesting, like the environment, you're talking there about the Spanish team going drinking in 2010. You naturally recoil at the thought of that, of these elite, finely tuned athletes to going and doing that to their bodies when they've got a World Cup semi-final or final coming up. But I've been, and this isn't World Cup related, this is Euros, but it's been a book for another book, looking into Euro 84 and the Denmark story there. For one particular aspect of it, they were out on the drink all the time, until 2 a.m, 3 a.m. One time they had a curfew of 5 a.m, and as long as they reported for breakfast at 11, it was all fine. It's absolutely bizarre, but you know, it's horses for courses to some extent, isn't it? You got to know your audience and know the culture of the group, and what works best for them. And yeah, it's fascinating how it comes together. It must be such a risky decision. At times, some of these things, you know, some are more risky than others, but some of the things people do for that edge to create the bond, to create the unity, or to try and build it as the momentum of the tournament, the pressures are growing and growing to try and release that tension. It must be a risk, because obviously you'll get slaughtered if it goes wrong and goes the other way. But when it goes right, it becomes part of folklore, doesn't it? Now, another really, really fascinating section in this book, Chris, was when you were talking about Brazil in 2014 with Big Phil, Philippe Scolari. Now, this is, you know, it's a fascinating subject in itself, just merely what happened to Brazil in that tournament. You know, the demons they were facing as a nation from 1950 and everything that happened then when they hosted it. And then the pressures, obviously, that were on them. Brazil face huge pressures in a World Cup regardless, don't they? But this was tenfold, I imagine, with it being in Brazil. Some incredible insight that he's given you into life at that time. It is really, really, really fascinating. But the biggest thing that he says is he wouldn't change anything. And I found that really interesting. I guess that just shows that to him, it was a sort of just a freak occurrence of what went wrong rather than anything that had gone wrong in how they'd worked and how they'd planned anything.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? Because, I mean, I remember asking him that, and he was kind of like, no, I'd have done exactly the same. And you think, you lost 7-1. And it just, you know, doesn't seem right. But actually, when you kind of hear him explain it, you get it a little bit, that there is this idea that, you know, I know footballers always say these sort of things, and actually you get it, this whole trust the process. And actually it is, because he'd done all these things and he had obviously put a lot of stuff in place, and he knows that based on that information, with no Neymar because he was injured, no Thiago Silva because he was suspended, that this was what he would do based on that information. And I guess the real thing is that confidence of this was the right thing to do. Because, you know, anyone else, you know, if you're in any working environment, if you've messed up that badly, you would expect to be like, yeah, I should have done this differently. But yeah, it was incredible that was his side. And look, maybe he's wrong. And you know, maybe he's right. Who knows? I mean, he said it was maybe one in a thousand game that that happened. And sure, look, 7-1 was a freak result, but there was no getting away from it that if they played it again, they would probably still have lost more often than they'd have won. But then maybe his point is also that there was nothing that Brazil could do. It was just Germany's time. And again, this idea of trajectories and, you know, national teams going on that journey, that it was just where Germany were. And, you know, Roberto Martinez talked about that in 2018, that they lost that semi-final to France. And he just said France were in a different point of their development to Belgium, and it was their time to go further, and Belgium needed to learn from that. And, you know, actually Deschamps spoke about that himself, that in 2016, losing the Euros final to Portugal at home actually paved the way for them to be world champions 2 years later. And if that 2016 defeat hadn't happened, they might not have gone on to win the World Cup. So there's all of these things that are kind of interlinked. And potentially that's what Scolari, maybe I'm trying to justify why he's saying what he's saying, but perhaps that's where he was coming from at that point, that, you know, Brazil had to play with the hand that he was dealt with, but Germany were just better, but perhaps not always 7-1 better. Who knows?
What do you think on that one, Dave? It's a fascinating area, isn't it? You know, possibly he's right that, you know, nothing would have been different in the end result. The outcome rather than the actual score, no matter what he'd done. But is he just trying to make himself feel better, do you think?
I think if you're managing at that level, with that, particularly as a host nation, with that level of scrutiny on it, there's got to be something in your makeup that is just ironclad self-confidence. Yeah, because otherwise you can't get to that point. I mean, Alf Ramsey was very much the same. His belief was always, if this is how we're going to play, and if we do all the things right, if we do all the things that I tell you, then we will win. You know, we will win the World Cup in 1966. There was absolutely no wavering from that. And I think to compete at that level, I think you've got to have some of that. I also think, you know, we ascribe things as failure. You know, Brazil got to the semi-final of the World Cup. Now I know in Brazilian terms that's not good enough. You know, we talk about Jurgen Klopp in you know, hushed, reverential tones. He's won one Premier League. Now, that's not to say that Liverpool haven't been a fantastic team over these last 5, 6, 7 years or whatever it is. It just happens to be a team that's been better. That doesn't mean that you haven't got a good team. It doesn't mean that you've made a, you know, you've done a lousy job. It just means that somebody else has got better resources. And as you say, is perhaps at a better point in their development. I think, you know, going back to what Martinez was saying, that one of the big things I think he said in your interview was, you don't pick the 11 best players. You pick players who are going to work together and blend together as a team on the pitch, off the pitch, the whole thing and through the process. And I remember doing the Ramsey book, speaking to Jack Charlton, and Jack Charlton said to Alf, well, why on earth have you picked me as a centre-half? Because, you know, there's lots of other better centre-halves in this country than me. And he said, well, you won't trust Bobby Moore either. And that was why he picked Jack Charlton. And that's the thing, it's blending the ingredients together, isn't it, to get that right blend. And I think if you're, you know, as a manager, you are the ultimate focal point. You're standing naked in front of your entire country. If you're going to do that, then you better believe in yourself, because otherwise nobody else is going to.
Oh, great point, yeah. It's when you say standing naked in front of your entire country, all that did flash into mind was stories about Louis van Gaal, having seen him coaching Netherlands today, about when he got his balls out in the changing room and, you know, showing off his prowess. But that's a whole other story. Anyway, in all the insight here, as a reader of this book, you know, plenty of areas we've covered here and loads more that we haven't touched on as well. As a reader of it, it's changed a lot of my preconceptions or preconceived ideas of what international management entailed, or the some of the areas that they had to focus on differently to what I may have thought. But for you, Chris, as the person whose idea this was, and I guess maybe you had different thoughts in advance, has it changed your preconceptions of international management and what they have to contend with?
I mean, I think the big thing for me is that I think I have a tendency to kind of back England manager. I remember being quite kind of like pro Hodgson for a while. that didn't end well. But I do think you'd probably appreciate more what Gareth Southgate is doing. I think that that's one of the big things for me, that I see some of the debates, particularly on social media now, in terms of what it takes to win, and you know, what Southgate's doing wrong. And actually, some of the things he gets criticized for most, from a theoretical point of view, actually is what serves people best. And I think it's, you see the trends and you see those things, like, you know, failing, and you know, failing in air quotes, in terms of like a semi-final and a final, you know, that's part of what countries do, and being pragmatic is part of what international managers do to be successful. And I think you know, keeping loyalty and picking Harry Maguire, he gets criticized for that and being over loyal, but loyalty is a key part of being a successful international manager. So there are things where I think maybe, would I have joined in the criticism in quite the same way? No, I wouldn't. But I think I have a new appreciation of what some of these guys have to do. And I think it's like synchronicity almost, that you kind of then, you see those things more often, and you see it more in the current manager's interviews and certain decisions they're making. And you start seeing, well, yeah, look, this is absolutely right. And there is, certainly at the moment, there is a blueprint that some managers have followed. And, you know, Southgate is following that himself, and people criticize that. But, you know, if it had been the start of the year, I would 100% be telling you, you know, England are on that right place based on everything that I've learned. They're in the right place to win this World Cup. I think that what went on earlier this year probably changes that a little bit. And I know, like, you know, today, as we are, you know, we've come on the back of a 6-2 victory, but I think, you know, there are still question marks because of what's gone in the past year. But theoretically, everything is in place, and it's, everything is in the right place for Gareth Southgate to become the next World Cup winning manager, which seems like a big leap. But, you know, the theory of what I've done, he ticks the box for almost every criteria for that. And so do England.
Ooh, big call. Well, we'll see how that turns out.
I said in theory.
In theory, exactly, exactly. And that's all it is. Perfect. Dave, obviously we talked there, Southgate, and Chris mentioned the sort of air quotes of failure, and obviously he hasn't failed, but, you know, it kind of feeds into the idea that, do you think international managers are judged unfairly in some ways because it's such a small sample size of matches that are actually the ones you judge them on? You know, you can have a whole body of work of qualifying and all this and that, and it can all go marvelously, but then lose one or two games at the wrong time in a tournament, and that the whole thing's undone. And your reputation is in tatters?
I think definitely so. I mean, there's one World Cup every 4 years, to state the bleeding obvious. And there's only one country that wins it, you know? I mean, if you're an international manager, you don't get many cracks at winning a World Cup. Same as winning an Olympic gold medal in the 100 metres or whatever it is. You know, it comes around very seldom. And, you know, however well you prepare, however good your side is, all the work that you've done. The other thing that happens is over 4 weeks, something will happen and you've got to be light on your feet. And I think in an England context, we've seen that for good nil. I mean, for Alf Ramsey, there was the Jimmy Greaves injury. Now, that before the World Cup would have seemed an absolute catastrophe. Instead, it paved the way for England to change slightly, to bring in Jeff Hurston to win the World Cup. You know, you could have talked about in 86, the injury to Brian Robson and the sending off of Ray Wilkins should have ended England's campaign, and all of a sudden they went from strength to strength. And I think that's the great unknown within any competition, within any tournament. Something will happen. Somebody will get injured. Somebody will get sent off. Somebody will wear the wrong armband and get booked or something. And then you've got to react to that. And I think that is the great test of money. You know, going back to the Spanish example, I'm sure he didn't plan months in advance that he'd allow him to go out and get smashed, having won a game. But reacting to that event and the mood in the camp and the way those players were feeling, that was the right thing to do at that moment. And I think that's always going to be the test of any tournament, because you can do all your planning and you can visualise how you're going to play and who you're going to play against and all of that. But events will happen and that will change it. And if you can react to that, that's when you're going to go and win it. And yeah, any manager who does that and goes on and wins a World Cup deserves all the praise they can get. I think the ones who don't do it deserve a bit more sympathy than they get as well.
Yes, I would agree on that. And when teams do find the formula to win, Chris. In recent times, that's frequently led to a complete collapse in the following tournament. Why do you think that is?
I mean, so I'm going to try. I feel like in the past hour, I think I sound like some sort of amateur psychologist here, but I feel like it's it's human instinct again, because a lot of the managers end up, they don't evolve because they have that sort of loyalty to the winners from 4 years earlier. And as we know, I mean, look at the difference in England's squad now compared to the side that got to the 2018 semi-final. I mean, Dele Alli was key, Jesse Lingard. If they weren't playing, it was Ruben Loftus-Cheek. And none of these guys were really close at all to coming along. And I think, so keeping the faith in some of these guys, as much as I've gone and said that loyalty is really important, I think over the course of 4 years, that transition happens. You can't just chop and change within a year, but over the course of four, you can and you have to. And I think there's a lot of these guys who can't give up the ones who've led them to the top of that mountain before and haven't got that sort of ability almost to, as a human, to chuck away these people who've served them so well. And I think these managers almost kind of, that's the end of their cycle. And I think in particular for Del Bosco with Spain, you know, these guys have been in his corner and fought for him and achieved what they did. And also, you know, Del Bosco's got an autistic son, and I think he'd been in the dressing room, and this group of brilliant Spanish footballers had made Del Bosco's son feel so special and looked after him as well. And I think there was that sort of, that strength of bond that had been such a big asset for them actually turned into the weakness, because Del Bosco could not cut these guys. He could not bring in the new players that needed to come in to refresh the side. And eventually that ended with, you know, catastrophe in 2014. I think you see that with a lot of people. You know, Germany last time out was exactly the same, that there was, you know, talk of the new breed hadn't come in and they felt their wings had been clipped. I think there is a feeling that the best thing to do if you win the World Cup and you've kind of reached the top of that tree is probably to knock it on the head and not go again. It'd be interesting to hear how Deschamps gets on this World Cup, because again, you'd kind of think that France, it probably wouldn't have worked. And I don't think it would have worked again with Pogba and Kante being there and Varane being fully fit. And if they're, you know, all these guys, you take them out, it might actually be a blessing in disguise, because he now has to embrace these new guys. And in midfield in particular, it looks like there's going to be what Camavinga and Tchouaméni, and they perhaps wouldn't have started, but now this is their chance. And Deschamps may have, in a strange way, have strengthened his hand by weakening his personnel in a sort of strange sort of fashion. And I think that's an interesting dynamic to watch this tournament, I think.
Yeah, it will be interesting. You often thought successful managers should go on a high, and if they won't go, they should be shoved on a high. You never keep them on. It doesn't seem like the best plan because, yeah, as you say, it's just repeating the same old and it never seems to quite go right. Well, just before we wrap things up then, a sort of final question. Now, you are clearly the authority on this, Chris. I'm declaring you as such because you've written this book, and it's an excellent book. So you are the authority on international management and what it takes to win a World Cup. So given all of that and all your research and writing on the topic, you've talked about the theory of Gareth Southgate in England and so on, but who overall do you see as best placed to win the 22 World Cup?
I mean, I think this is going to be one of the most open tournaments ever, to be completely honest. I think there's so many runners and riders. I mean, I think it's going to be European nation, simply because, and this isn't a managerial basis, it's based on trends, that there hasn't been a non-European winner since 2002. And while everyone's talking Argentina and Brazil up for their great runs, they actually haven't played any European qualifier of the World Cup this time within that four-year gap. So it's a little bit of an inflated run of form. And I know Argentina swatted aside Italy as European champions in the finalissima, and obviously that counts for something, but I wonder whether that's going to be something they'll struggle with. And you go to the European nations, I mean, I'm trying not to say England. I've tipped Spain, although I think that since I've tipped Spain, some things have changed with Luis Enrique and the Spanish squad, but they are similarly under the radar a side that is new, and they have already started and been on that trajectory themselves. they should have got to the Euros final, perhaps should have won Euro 2020 and lost the penalty shootout. You know, there they could have done so much better in 2018, but they changed Lopetegui right before the tournament kicked off. They got to the Nations League final in the past year as well. And I kind of think that they perhaps are the ones that I would suggest that they might have a good chance, a better chance than some people are giving them. I might be completely wrong here, but I feel like it's someone like that. I think Germany are too green. I think France, I feel, were kind of on that wrong side of being previous winners. And that's where I kind of end up with England and Spain sitting there. And I just don't want to tip England. So yeah, Spain for me.
Well, they were very, very good in the Euros, weren't they? Especially in that semi-final. It was a magnificent game. And yeah, you're right. There were, you know, a few penalties here and there, and it could have been them in the final. And who knows what would have happened then. England probably wouldn't have been able to live with them. Dave, sorry, you're not the authority on this, but I'm still going to ask you anyway. Who do you see as the best place to win the World Cup?
I know who won then. the romantic in me thinks that, you know, Messi will finally crown the great career by carrying off, but I would go for Spain as well, to be honest, as my pick. I do think for England, a lot of things have come together in the sense of it's not at the end of the cliche alert, grueling English season where everybody's knackered and they can't stand up anymore. So, I mean, that should work in England's favour. And I think the fact that there wasn't the long training camp beforehand where they all get bored to death and want to kill one another and complain about the ketchup, that might also play into England. I think it's in the English psyche that they'll go, they'll play, they'll come home. Other nations, it's within their culture that they, you know, they go to training camps. The Germans are used to it. The Italians are used to it. It's what they do. And they're better prepared for it, whereas the English teams tend to get bored. So I think in that sense, lots of things are falling into place for England. But I would say probably Spain would be my favourite champ.
Okay, so you're both trying not to say England and you're just saying Spain.
And now it's your turn.
Yeah. No, it's my turn. Right, okay. Well, I'm not going to say England either because I just see the Euros as being the big missed opportunity. Mm. I don't see them being as good now, or at least running into someone they can't get past, whether that's France or even Denmark, someone like that, as potential opponents coming up. I don't think so for them. I would go personally, I get what you're saying about European teams, but I think Brazil have got so much talent on their hands, you know, European-based primarily as well. So I don't think that difference is as big as it would have been in the past. I think if they can get it together, and obviously at the point we're talking here, we haven't seen Spain or Brazil or many of these countries play, so we don't quite know how that's going to come together. We all might sound foolish, but I think they've got such an array of talent that I think, again, has been building for a little time and they've added bits to it that I think this could be their time again. But we will see. We will see very, very soon indeed. Well, that will wrap it up there for tonight. It's been a fascinating chat. A heads up for the book again, How to Win the World Cup, Secrets and Insights from International Football's Top Managers. If you want insight into the thinking and what's going on behind the scenes as you're watching on the World Cup action in Qatar, this book will give you that in spades and a lot more besides. So I can't recommend it highly enough. It's a fantastic book, Chris. So thank you so much for coming on. It's been a great chat.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
And cheers, Dave. As always, another good one to get into.
Yeah, pleasure. And I echo everything you say about the book. Get onto Amazon or Waterstones or your favourite bookseller now.
Exactly. Do all of that and you'll have the copy of the book to go along with the pod while you're still watching the action in Qatar, and you'll know exactly what's going on in the thinking behind it all. Well, we'll wrap it up there then. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening as well, and do join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.